to Elise Sutkus of EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Urbanization, who will be today's moderator. Elise?
Thank you, Abe. All right, can everyone hear me all okay?
I can hear you.
Thanks. So thanks, everybody, to the participants and to our speakers for joining this afternoon. My name is Elise Sutkus, and I work in EPA's Office of Land and Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. My office primarily manages a grants program to help communities, states, and tribes to assess and clean up contaminated or potentially contaminated properties, also known as brownfields. Our land revitalization part of our program is focused on reusing properties and helping communities to reuse properties in a way that provides environmental, equitable, and economic benefits. Right. So in just a few minutes, I will turn things over to our guest speakers. So on today's webinar, we have Matt Ward, who will take us through a lot of the presentation. Matt Ward is the CEO of Sustainable Strategies, BC, and he has a lot of experience working as a contractor for EPA, providing land revitalization technical assistance. Through his work, he's helped a lot of communities identify funding opportunities that are relevant to their land revitalization projects. And outside of his work providing technical assistance for EPA, he's consulted for a lot of communities, and the tools that we will talk about today are ones that he's found particularly effective in helping communities figure out what types of funding they need and how to access that funding. Some of Matt's experience also includes working with Deborah Figueroa on leveraging funds in the cities of Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Deborah has successfully been implementing these approaches in these two cities, and she will share more about her experiences later. In terms of agenda, Matt will present on resource roadmap, funding matrix, and briefing sheet. We'll learn what these tools are and how they can be used to help leverage funds for developing brownfields and for land revitalization, as well as the steps that you need to pull these tools together in your own communities. We will also have Deborah talking about her experience using these tools in Carlisle and Glenwood Springs. And we will also have some time for Q&A, a short break for Q&A in the middle of the presentation and again at the end of the presentation. So before we get started, I just wanted to mention that as part of EPA's Land Revitalization Program, we're emphasizing how we can help communities redevelop sites and better understand the development process. Our goal is to help communities feel empowered in the redevelopment process and help them understand there are things they can be doing, even if the market isn't great, if there's financing challenges, there are steps that communities can take to help make their sites more attractive to developers. So the two guides referenced here are particularly relevant to today's webinar. The guides on community actions that drive brownfields redevelopment and leveraging resources for brownfields revitalization. Both reference the resource roadmap approach and some of the steps that are involved, and we wanted to go into more detail on these specific tools, which is why we're having this webinar. So you can follow the link there on this slide, and that will take you to our EPA Land Revitalization Toolkit page that has these guides in addition to a lot of other resources. And with that, I will turn things over to Matt to get started.
Thanks, Elise. Thanks, Abraham. It's good to be here with everybody from across the country to talk about leveraging resources for your brownfield and community revitalization. Again, I'm Matt Ward. I'm pleased to be here with you and with my longtime friend and colleague, Deborah Figueroa, who is one of the best road mappers in the United States of America. So I look forward to hearing her talk about how she has used these resource road mapping tools in our own communities to help move those places forward. So when you are redeveloping a brownfield, when you are cleaning up a dead factory or an abandoned gas station, when you are revitalizing a riverfront or a rail yard or a blighted area of your downtown, you need resources, you need money, not just for brownfield assessment and cleanup, but for infrastructure upgrades, for parks and trails and stormwater and utilities and roads. and sidewalks and for the vertical development that represents the vision for revitalization that you have there, and that takes money. It takes resources. And so we're going to talk today not about the technical aspects of brownfields assessment or about redevelopment strategies. All of those are at EPA's office in their land revitalization toolkit and other places. We're going to talk about leveraging the funding that you need to get to your revitalization. So the good news is, even in this strange and difficult age that we're living in, the funding for revitalization is still there. Mark Twain, when he read his obituary in a newspaper, said the next day that the rumors about my death are premature, and the rumors about there not being funding to do these projects is also not quite correct. There are very high levels of federal appropriations, as high as they've been in the 27 years that I've been in Washington helping on community revitalization. Many states, although in economic struggle right now, are also putting out a significant funding for community revitalization and infrastructure. We have had about $3 trillion of COVID response legislation, particularly the CARES Act, contained by our count about $160 to $175 billion of resources that could be directly involved in brownfields revitalization and community revitalization. And we have private investment vehicles like the Opportunity Zone program that is putting tens of billions of dollars into real estate and economic development. So the funding is out there, but the challenges and barriers still remain. Let's see if there are still challenges, and it's difficult to navigate this process. So first of all, finding the funding that matches your project need is not always easy. Navigating the complexity of any individual funding source, let alone leveraging multiple funding sources, private funding, state funding, philanthropic funding together, can be exceedingly difficult. Fitting the round peg of funding into the square hole, or vice versa, of your project can be difficult because funding programs typically have very specific parameters and constraints, and it may not perfectly match what you're trying to do with a land revitalization project. And then being able to shape your project and develop your project in a way that it can win that grant in highly competitive grant competitions where not every project is funded can also be a skill. It can be a challenge and barrier. A big throttle on people going for grants is that you might have to have a 20%, a 50%, even higher match level coming from a source that is outside of the level of government, a non-federal source for a federal grant, a match for a philanthropic grant. And how do you raise that? How do you fit different sources of funding together to produce match and get a project funded? This all takes time and effort. Local governments are under as much strain in their capacity as they ever have been. And most local government officials, city and county and town officials, EPA brownfield grantees are not spending all day long writing grants, managing grants, trying to figure out how they fit together. So there's strains on local capacity to leverage these resources. And because they're so competitive, you really need to get out and advocate to your state officials, to your federal officials, to the agency funders, to the philanthropic agencies that are putting money into these types of projects. And all of this takes effort. It's like a maze. So what do you need to get through this maze? And I'll tell you, you need a resource roadmap, because if you don't have a view of the long-term strategy for putting together funding for your community or for your particular brownfield revitalization projects, it conjures up the old saying from the great Yogi Berra, who said you've got to be very careful if you don't know where you are going, because you might not get there. And that applies with funding as well. If you just wait for a grant application to come out and say, oh golly, we have 45 days to turn it in. Well, hopefully I can get somebody in this organization to write the grant. Not sure what the project is. Don't know if I have the backing of the city council. Haven't ever thought about match. Maybe we'll apply. Well, now we only have 29 days left. Now we only have 20 days left. Let's throw a grant application in. Is not a strategic way of figuring out the steps and phases and components of an overall revitalization plan and how over the life of that project you're going to leverage resources on top of resources, bring them together to be able to get to the finish line of a ribbon cutting with that project. So you need a strategy for funding just as much as you need a playbook for getting into a sports tournament at the end of the year. You don't start conditioning and thinking about the plays and lining up your roster the week before the tournament. You have to put together a roadmap to win that tournament, and you need to have a resource roadmap to leverage resources. So that's what we're going to talk about here. We're going to talk about the resource roadmap in particular, but there are a couple component pieces of a resource roadmap that we're also going to discuss, and they're called the resource roadmap, the funding matrix, and the briefing sheet. And that's what we're going to talk about, tools that will get you more bang for your buck. All three of these tools are used to identify, find, parse through, decide what funding sources you're going to go after. These are tools to help you pursue them and advocate for funding for your revitalization projects. A resource roadmap is a comprehensive document. It can be a weighty document. We've done them as short as 10 pages or as long as 50 pages that are used as internal planning documents for your team. They're really for your department, your steering committee, your leader of the project to really understand what are the priorities for revitalization of this riverfront or this rail yard. Breaking those projects into digestible bites that you can chew and digest, key components and phases, matching those needs and costs and gaps to specific sources of funding, and then defining tactics and preliminary steps that you have to undertake if you're going to go after those specific sources. And this can tell your management officials within your local government or other organization, it can tell your political officials, it can tell your budgeting and capital planning officials, here is the next 24, 36 months of us funding this endeavor, broken down into piece-by-piece strategies, grants and loans and tax incentives lined up, when they fit in, how much they'll provide, and what we need to do to get there. Can we go on this 36-month endeavor rather than we got a grant due in 22 days, can you give me a $500,000 match by the next council meeting, which normally doesn't work. Okay. The funding matrix is really nothing more than a short summary of the roadmap. It's a summary version of the key resources that you're going to go after and for what purposes. And this is more of an external, outward-facing document that you can show your city council members, your member of Congress, the state economic cabinet deputy secretary. This is our matrix of the funds that we want to leverage together over the coming 1, 2, 3, 4 years, and we're going to need to go step by step in getting these resources, and you see how it all fits together. So no member of Congress, no state cabinet official is going to read your 25-page planning document, so a funding matrix is about giving them the kind of a summary version of that. And then the briefing sheet is a critical tool. When I work with communities, we always insist that once we get past the initial discussion of whether we're going to go for funding, we're going to put together a briefing sheet that summarizes what the project is, why it has benefit, and why you, state official, why you, governor, why you, state delegate, should get behind this project and how you can specifically help us fund it as we move forward. So those are the three tools we're going to focus on. You can see this simple graphic shows that a resource roadmap has within it a funding matrix, kind of a summary of what's in the roadmap, and then each individual project. There might be a project just about restoring the riverfront, which might take the Corps of Engineers, it might take natural resource agencies, may take a whole variety of particular environmental tasks and funds and projects. And so you might have a briefing sheet, one that's about the riverfront aspect, and there might be a different briefing sheet about the economic development and vertical building development that you want to do. That might be a different briefing sheet depending on who your audience is, what the agency is, what the funder cares about. So we're going to talk about those. All right, a little bit more details about the resource roadmap, why you need one, and what you would do with it. Okay, a resource roadmap is a written game plan identifying of the 5, 10, 20, 100 important things that we could do within this area of town or within this abandoned industrial area or within this redevelopment area. What are the 2, 3, 5 priorities? What is the most catalytic? What is the most transformational? What needs to be done because of the most dire economic or public health needs in this section of town? What are we really going to focus on? And then with each priority project, what are the key components and phases of it? We'll talk more about that. And then from that, what do you think those are going to cost? And how much have we already raised? And what is our gap? If you don't know these things, you're not going to be effective in leveraging more resources for the next stage. So you will match your project needs and components to sources of funding. This document will lay out the typical funding ranges we can get. If you go into a grant hoping that you'll get $8 million and the average grant from that agency is $750,000, you might be barking up the wrong tree, or you need to find other trees to bark up as well, because you're not going to raise $8 million from it. And what match do we have to have? What would be an eligible match? Can I match grant A against grant B, or am I going to have to budget it within my own capital project or use a tax increment financing source to raise match or borrow it from a subsidized lending program that the state or federal government sponsors? All of those things go into a funding roadmap. And then who do I call? Who's my key contact? Do I have to get into a state transportation improvement program with this road? Or do I have to get into the regional, what they call a comprehensive economic development strategy, or SEDS, before I would ever qualify for funding from that Economic Development Administration at the federal level? If you don't know these things and they sneak up on you, then you're not going to be successful in securing those resources. This document will guide your project teams, your local leadership, your budget planners, your funders who are supporting you over the months and years can have confidence that you know where you're going and you know how it all fits together and that you have a plan for sustainably bringing it to fruition. I'll tell you that we sometimes will go into a community. I've worked with Deborah in two different communities that she'll talk about, and we've done road mapping for their law enforcement needs and their public health and their arts and cultural and everything. Or it can be more specific and can be just for this one 50-acre brownfield that's a big problem in our community that has lots of problems but lots of opportunities. It can be a targeted roadmap as well. And that's really up to you and the scope of your endeavor and responsibilities and your vision. They're not static documents. You can't put one together and 12 years later still be reading from the same roadmap. You should update it as you secure funds, as you accomplish projects, as priorities fall off the board and other priorities emerge, as new funding sources develop. It can be a dynamic document. And I have to stress what we all know, that we are in a different time. We're in a time that has been a crisis of public health, a crisis in our communities, a crisis in our economy. We've had all kinds of economic and social strife. There's never been a better time for you to say, what are our priorities? What are the projects that are really important to us now? It may be the same as it was last year. It may be different. And then how do we put resources, including lots of new resources that are coming up? I'm going to talk in a little bit about how we're probably going to see perhaps a $1 trillion infrastructure bill coming about in the next year or so. Are you ready for it? Do you know what projects would use that infrastructure bill and how you are roadmapped to putting that infrastructure down? If you're not, time's a-wasting. So now is as good a time as ever to have a resource roadmap. Okay, just quickly, the funding matrix and the briefing sheet. A funding matrix is a summation of the funding targets you're pursuing, and it's organized usually in a chart: project name, project purpose, fund we're targeting for, how much we're looking for, what's the next step, or a note that you could hand on one sheet of paper to a state official or to a congressional legislative aide and say, this is how we're going to get this riverfront rebuilt and redeveloped with our vision. We need help with getting these funds. And you don't have to, you know, try to parse all of our phone calls or read our inch-thick roadmap. We're telling you what we need to do over the next couple of years to get this project done. That's a funding matrix. A briefing sheet is more of a description of the project. What is the project? What is the vision? Is there a picture, a rendering of what that place would look like when restored and revitalized? Who is behind it? What are the project outcomes? And what are the, you know, the last paragraph or the last couple lines of your briefing sheet should say, and we need a Corps of Engineers Section 206 Aquatic Ecosystem Restoration Study if we're going to move to the next stage. And we're looking for $1 million for that. And so that is not solely funding. It's really the one page, one piece of paper. You can go front and back, but no staples. If you're giving a state funding official or an agency official a 12 or 15 page document and asking them to read it, digest it, and understand what you're doing, that's not a good briefing sheet. It should be a no staple document. Okay, so with those tools, I'm going to turn it over to one of the most talented municipal managers in the country. She has done extraordinary brownfield and community revitalization work in those two towns. Deborah Figueroa, the city manager of Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Take it away. I think you're mute.
Deborah, you're on mute.
Okay. Good afternoon. Before I get started, I just want to say thank you, Matt. And honestly, over the last 7 years I've been working for Matt, I have learned everything from him and his associates. And so thank you. Okay. I got to Carlisle, Pennsylvania in late 2012, and it was pretty clear we needed to do something big. We had three factories that had closed down, and then a massive fire in the largest one, which in the poorest neighborhood in the borough of Carlisle, so the entire area was just completely devastated. I made it to Glenwood Springs in 2016, and we had sewer plant at the confluence of the Colorado River and the Roaring Fork River that had been abandoned for almost a decade right outside of the heart of downtown. I learned in Carlisle that we needed a roadmap for revitalization to help redevelop that area. So by the time I got to Glenwood Springs, I already had many of the tools in my tool belt to push forward. So both of these communities use the resource road mapping process that Matt has described to you. We identified our revitalization priorities. We figured out what kind of matches we would need. We worked with professionals to figure out, you know, what the estimates really were to start pushing forward on these projects. Because if you don't know where you're starting, you certainly can't get the funding you need to push your community forward through, you know, securing funds from states, the federal government, private sector resources, and philanthropic sources. The result of which has been over $150 million leveraged into both of the communities I worked for. If you take a look at the picture on top is a groundbreaking in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
And then the picture on the bottom is a ribbon cutting for a Grand Avenue Bridge project with former Governor Hickenlooper. And what Matt will say it, but I want to emphasize it beforehand, celebrate every success you have because success breeds success, and you never know who you can talk to at a ribbon cutting to get funding for your next project. Okay, I think we are now in the question and answer section for this part of the presentation.
Yep, so this is Elise. I just wanted to give a brief reminder to everybody that our webinar slides and related handouts are available on our webinar registration page. So under the webinar slides and related links tabs, you can download those. We have links to all of the EPA resources that will be mentioned during today's webinar, in addition to some non-EPA resources and example resource roadmaps, briefing sheets, and a funding matrix as well for Carlisle, Glenwood Springs, and another community. All right, so for questions, I would like to ask Matt, with so many competing priorities right now, what would you say is the level of effort needed for creating something like a resource roadmap?
Right. It can be a bit of work, but it's important work. And what I mean by that is, you really need, as we're going to go through in specific slides, to convene the right people, the right groups of people, with stakeholders from outside, you know, the very core of your organization, key public, key neighborhoods, key stakeholders, and figure out what's really important. You know, we've seen that abandoned site for a long time. We've got an assessment done there. We know it's not too dirty. What do we really want to do there? What is our vision? What are the components of that? That takes work. And so that can take months and months to develop a community consensus on that. But assuming you know what the intended reuse vision is and what key components are, and now it's time to raise funding, then, I did a webcast like this, and I mentioned the resource roadmap, and the little city of Okemah, Oklahoma, was on that, and they asked whether we could do a resource roadmap with them, and I had a big conference call with them yesterday. I was supposed to be out there next week. We're going to do it all virtually, and it's going to take about a month to get together a roadmap. It'll take, depending on whether you're focused on one small abandoned gas station with a dirty petroleum tank underneath it, which is a relatively small project. Or, you know, I was on the phone actually this morning with Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and they have a 300-acre abandoned state mental hospital with 46 buildings there. That will take more effort. But, boy, they need a resource roadmap to be able to figure out what it will take to turn that place around. And I think it's worth it. Once you have it, it makes everything else easier. It's a heck of a lot better, Elise, than trying to do funding by the seat of your pants.
Okay, thanks, Matt. We have another question, basically about project readiness. So how far along in the project planning should you be when you start a resource roadmap development? So for example, could you be doing an assessment in tandem with starting your visioning?
It's a great question, and I would highly recommend that you start early, right at the beginning, assuming you have more than a big piece of contaminated dirt with no concept, no support, and no nothing. I mean, assuming you're past that, if you know it's a priority revitalization site and you're just going through the environmental assessment and investigation process, you should start a roadmap as soon as you start to develop an idea about the reuse. And you don't have to know what all the vertical development will be. You might just know we don't have sewer and water lines that are updated at this site. We know we're going to have to deal with stormwater issues because there are no stormwater controls there. We also know that there's an opioid problem in that part of town, and there's a lot of unhealthy people and crime. and blight that are in that neighborhood, we're not going to be able to attract development into that area very well if we have these socioeconomic challenges. And so we're going to have to think about that as well. All of those can get going even if you don't know if it's going to be a Four Seasons hotel or a Hilton hotel, you know, with a sandwich shop or a yogurt shop beside it, because that takes time. The roadmap, as we'll discuss, should have funding strategies for the early stages of planning and feasibility analysis and preliminary engineering and preliminary programming of how are we going to run this show if we put together a whole new arts and culture district in that downgraded area with a couple old brownfields in it. All of that is fundable as well and can be part of the roadmap. So I say start yesterday.
Thanks, Matt. I have another question. Are you seeing changes in roadmaps that are in the redevelopment phase based on the economic Durantown, lower demand for any high cost per square foot office buildings or residences in urban areas, also in relation to the environmental justice movement?
That's a fantastic question as well. I just mentioned a hotel. I would hate to be a hotel developer right now. Hotels, hospitality, movie theaters, I mean, obviously those are industries that are under significant economic stress and maybe for a while. I think we all hope and believe that there will be a post-COVID time for us to rebuild where we might get back to a normal semblance of life. But there's a lot of questions about that. We're definitely seeing that. We're seeing that expectations of using tax increment financing, TIF increment, to pay for a lot of things are in a difficult place because you don't have the same expectations of revenue production that might come from the development of a place that was planned before the virus came. I will tell you that sustainable strategies, our staff, our team got together. We felt it was very important to talk about equity and racial inclusion and the issues of environmental and economic justice and how are we going to incorporate those into the roadmapping process in a much more robust way and not as a side item or a quick check the box type exercise. And if you're putting together a roadmap for the future revitalization of a part of your city or town, boy, you better be thinking about these issues. What are the new ways that we're going to interact in a healthy way and in a way that promotes equality and progress for all? I definitely think that. I wish I could tell you exactly what shape the economy rebound is going to be. Is it going to be a swoosh or a U or a W or a V? There are other financial analysts that are guessing about that. I think we all know that we're going to have a difficult rebuilding process. Some of our assumptions about what is easy to get done might not be safe assumptions anymore. Again, another reason for roadmapping, figure out what your priorities are in a new era. So that's my initial sense of that, Elise.
Okay, thank you, Matt. I see we still have a few more questions in the chat, but I think some of them might be covered by the rest of your presentation, and we'll see if that happens. We'll still have some time at the end of your presentation for some Q&A as well. So feel yeah. free to move on.
Okay, here we go. Done with the brief intermission. All right, I'm going to go through the step of roadmapping. Again, you don't prepare for the sports tournament by getting to the weekend before and saying, what is our plan and should we have been practicing? You really need to develop a disciplined process, a way of doing business to shape yourself up to be competitive for funding and successful in building funding upon funding. So let's talk about those keys. I'm going to go through them somewhat fast because each one of them could be a webinar topic. So first of all, get your project team together, kind of your internal team. Who is your project manager? Who is the champion? Who's the one who's going to be leading this? Frankly, with Deborah, She was the champion in Carlisle, and she is the champion in Glenwood Springs. But having your elected leaders, your mayor and your council bought in, having those key developers who are buying the land or own the land, those key neighborhood organizations, other economic development or community revitalization stakeholders, you need to put together a team. In my hometown of Charlestown, West Virginia, we organized a project called the Commerce Corridor, and we put together a team, and it stayed together for 20 years until really the whole corridor was redeveloped. And now those same people have moved on to other projects. But we had a team together for a long time, and you'll want that the backing of people that can help carry these projects forward. The second is start with the end in mind. You have to have a vision of where you're going. It doesn't have to be precise to the square foot, but, you know, does your community need affordable housing? Is it a crisis? Does your community need access to the riverfront? I'm working with a community that has 8 miles of riverfront and not a single square yard of public access to the riverfront. It was all covered in industry. It all closed. It's a 1,500-acre brownfield. They want riverfront access. Do you need commercial office space? Do you need a new corridor to get from one side of the town to the other? Your vision can be put down in a brownfield. And without the vision, it's not very compelling to go into funders and say, let me tell you, we've got this big 75-acre brownfield, and it's filled with solvents and Dean apples and heavy metals, and we figured out just how much there is. Can you give us a grant to put the infrastructure in for development? Well, development of what? We haven't figured that out. We haven't even really thought about it, but it's really dirty. It's the worst way to get a grant. So try to use the charrettes, the community planning, the community visioning. This is not new to communities. There are lots of organizations, lots of funding sources that can fund this part of your visioning. Then I talked about the internal team, number one. Number three is really building that support out in the neighborhoods. If you think about getting people support for a project vision and plan as an afterthought, you're going to be in for a rude awakening that it just might not have support, even if it's a good project, just because you were not engaged with the neighborhoods, the neighbors, the community organizations, the developers. Don't depend on a public hearing where people sit in the audience when we used to sit together in audiences and you speak from the dais about what's going to happen at this brownfield. You need to use charrettes and forums and social media and survey monkeys and community citizen advisory boards and all of those things that can help the public and the neighbors really be part of your vision. Just one second. Hey, I have 11 children, and like four of them are being very unquiet right now, so I'm back. All right, this is very important. The Land Revitalization Coordinator at EPA, Amy Storm, and her colleague, Elise, who's the moderator here, both said that they wanted to emphasize this. When you have a big abandoned steel plant with no development and no money, it is like a giant project that might take you a decade to fix. It's like eating an elephant. So how do you eat an elephant? We all know. One bite at a time. So I'm going to talk about eating the elephant one bite at a time. So first of all, you have to break your project down into components and phases. So look there at that layer cake on the right. That's a brownfield project. If somebody said, well, what kind of funding do you need? Well, it's a brownfield project. I could say back to you, well, is it a transportation upgrade project? Is it a stormwater project? Are the utilities involved? You need to do some creative placemaking, parks and rec, community health, housing, smart city technology, vertical development. I could make a 50-layer cake, and all of those may be involved in any particular brownfield project or certain components of them. Each one of those is fundable from different sources, different agencies, and in different ways. And if you don't break down the project into those components, you're going to be skipping funding sources because you didn't really think about the stormwater and how that is fundable from four or five different sources. Likewise, each project component, let's say you're going to have a waterfront trail with biking facilities along that riverfront through that old steel mill, there are different phases that can include planning, visioning, site acquisition. If you've got a brownfield, you're probably going to have to assess. You might have to demolish things. You might have to clean up the asbestos before you demolish. You got cleanup. There can be different phases of construction. You can do one segment now and another segment when you have more money. A lot of things that you build need to be operated. Each one of these phases can be fundable from a different source. In fact, some grants can only be used for planning, and others can only be used for shovel-ready construction projects. And if you don't understand that, when the grant funding notice comes out and it's due in another 60 days, you might say, doggone it, I was going to apply for a planning grant for this, and I didn't even know you can't do planning with this grant. Let's go back to the drawing board. We failed to figure all this out. So break your project down into its components and phases. Then with those components and phases, you can take the planning study for that bike path, the land acquisition costs, the demolition costs of the building we need to get out of the way. Oh, there's asbestos in it. And you can start to identify the project costs. You may have internal capacity in your engineering or public works department to do it. You may be able to go to vendors and say, I may be doing this project in the next couple of years. I can't promise that you'll get the procurement, but could you tell me about what you would charge? Could you take a good hard look at it and tell me, is this a $300,000 project or is it a $500,000 project? Or you can pay professional cost estimation, engineering firm cost estimators. I work with people all the time on that. I remember a big brownfield project that had this beautiful vision for this high-tech incubator that would be built there when it was done. And we asked the project manager, what do you think that incubator will cost? Well, we could do it for $3 million, but it might be $35 million. It might be $100 million. And I looked back at him and said, you're not ready to get funding because you have no idea what it costs. Go back and figure out what this project costs. And if you don't do that, you don't know whether you're asking for enough grant money or if the grant's the right size or if you can handle the match, so on and so forth. So create estimates of project cost. Okay, now you can start to plug the resources in. Maybe some of you thought with this resource roadmap that it was about just where's the money, what are the sources of grants? And there's a component to this webcast about that. But really it's about developing your projects, considering your projects, planning your projects in ways. We're at step six now before we even try to figure out what the grant sources are. So we could do a day's worth of workshop about the particular funding sources, which we're not going to do, but there are grants, which is the best money. It's free money. There are subsidized loans at every level of government, tax credits, private sources, philanthropic sources. You can leverage together local funds and incentives and bank and traditional lending tools with these other things. Sometimes you have to get a particular source of money. And I'm going to talk about ways you can find these sources, but you don't really know how to match these sources together with your project unless you did the first five steps. I will say that you need to do those other steps first, but you may change your project based on the fact that there's a new state program that's funding particular kinds of green infrastructure on brownfields. And there's a lot of resources now for doing rain gardens and bioswales. You may go back and say, we might as well look at doing rain gardens and bioswales in this brownfield and whether it's feasible and desirable for our redevelopment division, because our governor just set up a $20 million annual program with the state legislature to do it. So That's what road mapping is about. Okay, we're not going to talk about all the sources for road mapping, but here's some good places to start. Every 2 years or so, ELISA's office puts out the Brownfields Federal Programs Guide. Actually, Abe Parker and his firm are the ones that produce that every year. We've helped put this together. The latest version is from last year. It has more than 30 different sources of funding, federal funding, grants, loans, tax incentives that can go into your brownfields and community revitalization. There's a great tool, and a grantee of the EPA Brownfields Office is the Council of Development Finance Agencies, and they have a brownfields page that includes a financing toolkit that has information about many, many sources of funding and financing. And then I and my firm put together a resource directory for the funding that's available from the COVID stimulus bills. And I did that in a webcast with ICMA. You can see the a URL there for that PowerPoint, which has lots of hyperlinked information about those funding sources. And I did another one more recently with the Center for Creative Land Recycling, together with David Lloyd, the head of the National Brownfield Program, and Toby Rittner, the head of the Council of Development Finance Agencies. So I commend those resources to you and urge you to look at them. Okay, I'm just going to touch briefly on this to make the point that a resource roadmap is more important than ever. There's a lot of fighting about federal spending, but frankly, if one thing Washington can do, it can spend. And the FY20 year that we're in now has record-setting appropriations for many of the federal programs that fund community revitalization. The FY20-21 bills are in play right now. They're supposed to be done by the end of September. Congress normally doesn't get them done until Christmas time. But in the next handful of months, we're going to see more funding coming for all these federal agencies. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate started debating the COVID stimulus number 4. The House passed a $3 trillion package called the HEROES Act that has more funding than you could believe. The Senate version will not have $3 trillion. There's debate about whether it will be a $1 trillion package or $2 trillion package. That's a lot of money. There's a lot of resources there. If you don't know what your projects are or how to map them out or what your components are, you probably won't be very good at harnessing those resources. There's lots of information from EPA's Land Revitalization Program about opportunity zones. The EPA was highly successful in getting Treasury to define the opportunity zone funding program in a way that is very, very favorable to brownfields cleanup and redevelopment. So we urge you to look there. And then if I were a betting man, which I'm not, I would bet that we are not going to get an infrastructure bill this year. But I think next year we are slated to get an infrastructure bill. The federal roads bill, which is from 2016, called the FAST Act, is, 2012, is expiring at the end of 2020. Now, Congress will keep it on autopilot, but it's expiring. And there's lots of talk about infrastructure. I don't think it's serious enough talk yet in Washington that it's going to pass tomorrow. But when it does, it'll be a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. And if you don't know how your community revitalization projects and their transportation, utility, and energy infrastructure needs fit in to that, then you're not ready for that bill coming next year. Another reason to roadmap. Okay. I often, when I give this presentation, spend a lot of time on number 7, but the whole webinar is on number 7. And so all of these steps go into, you're really ready now. You've identified the vision, the priority projects, its components and phases, what each costs. You've started to think about what sources can fit into there. Now you can start to write these things down in a logical way. Some of the sample roadmaps that Elise said are available here on this webcast and available for download. You can see how other communities have put these together. This is the time you can really get your roadmap written down. All right, There are some COVID stimulus funds that have no match. And a friend of mine called it in the before is the time before COVID, there were a few grants that were 100% no match. That's frankly a rare thing. You normally have to have cost sharing, match, and leveraging of other resources to be able to get a grant or get some of these subsidized lending. And so think about that early. If you go into your county executive or your city manager 2 weeks before the city council meeting and say, I can get us $1 million if you can find $500,000 by the next council meeting, she will throw you out of her office because you should have come at the beginning of the year and said, for our capital budgeting for the next couple of years, I'm going to go for a US DOT build grant. We're going to need 20% on this, and I'm going to ask for $8 million. So can somebody start talking with me about $2 million and what it's going to take to put that together with the help of our state highway commissioner and a tax increment finance bond? You have to think about those ahead of time. And sometimes it's not just cash or your state highway commissioner with a generous checkbook. Usually you have to think about debt financing. You need to think about whether you can float your municipal general obligation bonds, whether you're willing to put together a tax increment financing or assessment district, whether you're willing to go to one of these sources I've listed. USDA has good loans that fit right into brownfields development, the community facilities loans. You can get brownfield cleanup revolving loan funds. The Economic Development Administration has loans, HUD, so on and so forth. You can only use those if you've figured out your capacity and willingness to borrow. That's both debt capacity, financial capacity. It's your political capacity. Will your city council go for that? Are they prepared for it? Do they think that project is worth it? Have you analyzed the repayment streams and the tax increment and the tax base and the revenue stream to pay back that loan? If you haven't thought about those things, you're probably not ready to use debt to accomplish a project, which means you're not ready to use it as a match, which might mean you're not ready to go for a lot of funds. You see how it all fits together. All right, I talked already about you've kind of developed your roadmap. You have your priority grants that you're going for next, your priority loans that you're going to go for next. You can sum it up in a document that is easily digestible and user-friendly that you can share with your funding patrons, with your political officials, with funding managers who will look at it and say, I don't know if I can help you with this grant, but we're going to be coming out with another kind of grant that may be able to help you accomplish that goal. So that's used in your funding advocacy. We have examples of that available for download through this EPA webcast. All right. Deborah Figueroa will remember in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, when we put that briefing sheet together. A briefing sheet is your walking around piece. I often go to brownfields and community revitalization conferences, and I'm up at the dais giving a presentation. I say, who came to this three-day conference with their business card? And every hand goes up. Who has an important project that they're working on? Every hand goes up. And who brought a project briefing sheet in this room filled with state officials and EPA officials and developers and philanthropic officials? And usually in a room of 100, one hand or two hands goes up. You really need a briefing sheet as your calling card. It should not have a staple. It can be front and back. It can be a little brochure style. What is the project? What are the benefits from it? Where are you at? What are your remaining project needs? We need a stormwater plan. We need stormwater funding. You know, we got horrible flooding down into the river there, and we're going to need to deal with that. What are the specific funding requests? We want a clean water state revolving fund, stormwater, growing greener grant, for $1 million. We know what we want next. Make it attractive. You can show pictures of how horrible the brownfield looks now. You can show renderings of what it would look like if your vision were fulfilled. And you can tailor this briefing sheet to specific agencies or specific funds. or specific visits to your state capital, distribute it widely and often, use it as a leave behind. Perhaps one of the most gratifying moments I ever saw is when we were with a small community in front of a federal agency that we had not visited before, and the agency official spun around in his desk and grabbed a briefing sheet that had been given to other agencies that were funders, and he said, "I know all about your project. I've been waiting for you to come and see me." And guess what? They gave a giant USDA community facilities grant to that community. So we have lots of examples of briefing sheets, including Carlisle and Glenwood Springs one, available for download. Put together your briefing sheet. Oh, and let me also say that if you can't put your project down on a piece of paper describing what it is, what benefits it would produce, who's behind it, and what you need next, you probably don't know where you're at on your project, and you're certainly not ready to go for funding. It is a discipline and an exercise to figure out what's there. And if you were about to write the paragraph on your briefing sheet that we have a willing developer who's willing to collaborate in this, and then you go, "Oh, I forgot, that developer hates us and pulls out the shotgun and drives us off the property every time we go over to that part of town," well, then you know what you got to do next. You got to work with the developer to find a deal or buy that site or gain access to that property. Okay, around in the corner now on these steps. So you know what your projects are. You know what funding they need. You know what funding you're going for. You've got a funding roadmap. You've got a funding matrix. You've got briefing sheets to describe your projects. Get your state elected officials, your state delegates and state senators, your state cabinet agencies. They tend to be much more approachable than the federal level, which of course serves the whole United States of America. There are some federal agencies that are very accessible, but you can get into your state offices. Even if you're not asking for state money, I will tell you that most of the big federal funds, the agencies will want to know, is your governor behind it? Is the state economic development director behind it? Are they leveraging funding into it? Are you on their lists? Are you prioritized by them? If they don't even know what your project is at the state level, the feds know that. And it doesn't bode well for funding. Likewise with philanthropy, if you say the state director of Health and Human Services is all behind this community health project on this brownfield, she knows all about it and she's backing it, we think it's a way for us to emerge from the COVID economy, that will bode well with the philanthropic funding effort you're going, as opposed to those state people, they hate us, the governor's a bum, we haven't even talked to them. I know you'd never say that, but you'd be surprised at the degrees of state involvement, and you got to get them involved. And then collaborate with federal agency officials. Number one mistake that I see is that people only start collaborating with federal officials when the grant application, the solicitation for grants, is out on the streets. It's due in about a month, and now I want to talk to these feds and tell them where my town is located and what my project is and why I need help. Many agencies won't even talk to you during that blackout period when the grant is available, let alone come and visit your site and tour your site and meet with officials and get invested and become a supporter of the project. All that can be done with site visits to your site, visits to your regional federal agency offices. All of my clients come to Washington once or twice a year, except this year, we've slowed down a little. Stay in touch and make them part of the project, not just the trough where you're going to go feed for a grant. When that grant's there, make them a dynamic part of shaping and improving your project. Okay. A great way to do things once you've figured out all these other steps of what your projects are and what your priorities are and how it gets funded and what funds you need and how to do it is to hold a resource roundtable. You can see there the mayor of Huntington, West Virginia on the left beside the man at the White House who was running a big Appalachian Regional Commission and Economic Development Administration program, beside the head of the Appalachian Regional Commission, beside the head of the Economic Development Administration, beside a U.S. congressman. The audience is filled with community stakeholders that have been spending the previous year or so getting ready for this project. And the stakeholder forum was trying to bring it to a head and say, we're really ready to go for these things. We need your backing. And guess what? That community's leveraged tens of millions of dollars for these projects. The good news is that EMS, Abe Parker on the phone, together with Elise's office, the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, put together a tool called a stakeholder forum kit. You have the URL there that talks about a good way to do these things. So that's a resource roundtable. All right. Everything we've been talking about so far is preparing for grant writing, but there are some specific ways you should prepare for the grant writing before the application is out on the streets and is going to be due. Who is going to write it? Who is drawing that straw within your organization to write it? Or are you going to hire an external grant writer? Have you been in touch with the agencies? Have you determined your eligibility? Most grants are repeat programs of programs that have been around for a long time. You can pull out the grant guidelines from last year. You can pull out sample applications from previous years. They're going to be most likely very similar, if not identical, to the one that will be coming out 6 months from now. Did you apply in the past and you didn't succeed? Get that debrief. There are lots of ways that you can get ready now, and then when that solicitation hits the streets and it's due in 60 days, you're ready to go. Okay. My good friend Deborah, oh wait, I got one more slide after this. So advocating, it is very important. One of my sons when he was young says, Dad, you're a lobbyist, what do you do? And I said, I just talk on and on and on about the importance of the project until somebody listens. And it's true, you need to be persistent. You need to figure out who within your organization knows state and federal officials, who has relationships with them. You need to get the backing of the people that matter in your community who know these people, whether they be the Congress member or a federal agency person who used to be a state agency person that I worked with 10 years ago. You need to go meet with these people. The EPA regional brownfield contacts are invaluable people to help you shape and develop your projects, including by leveraging resources. Prep all your staff to say, here are the briefing sheets on this project. I want you to have a stack of them in your briefcase. And when you're in the state capitol, I want you to show people. I want you to know the funding matrix. I don't want it to be a mystery to you what we're doing with funding over the next year or two. And then you got to make the pitch, make the ask, and be persistent. So advocate for sure. All right, my good friend Deborah is right. Nothing succeeds like success. Success builds upon success. Other funders will want to get involved in successful projects. Other funders will want to build on the progress that you achieved last year with other grant funding. Funders will want to give you another version of the grant that they gave you 2 years ago because you spent it well. And so I worked with a mayor in a small town in New York, and they couldn't knock down a building without having a big show where he would get those, like, Wile E. Coyote red dynamite boxes with the plungers and, you know, blow up the building, or he'd get in a wrecking ball and make the Congress member put on a helmet and swing the wrecking ball, or they were going to lay the first brick on a trail along the waterfront. Everything was an event. Thank your funders. Write letters to the editor about how much your funders made it possible. Hold groundbreaking ceremonies, because I'll tell you, there's one thing that's nothing better in the brownfields and community revitalization world, and it is shovels and scissors. You're going to want to have groundbreakings and ribbon cuttings to celebrate the success of leveraging resources and moving your projects forward. Okay, and with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Deborah, who's had a lot of shovels and scissors and more to come, to talk about how she did it in Carlisle.
Okay, before I get started, I wanted to point out two things so I don't forget. Number one, most city employees are used to being in the background. They're not used to saying how important their projects are or why their city deserves XYZ. If this is something you're going to do, you have to get over that. I mean, you have to be ready and prepared to say, my city's project is important. It is the most important one in the state, and you need to fund it because of XYZ. So you got to get over the shyness and the resistance that we good bureaucrats have. I mean, the first time I walked into a senator's office, Matt could have picked me off the floor in a puddle. I was so scared. So you just got to get through that. The second thing I think is really important is finding a grant writing team and a planning team that you're really comfortable working with, that you have a really good relationship with and is going to help you. And if they can work together really well, that is wonderful. You know, going after these large grants is exciting, it's fun, and it's devastating when you don't get one. It's very, you know, your council's depressed, you're really sad, and you need your team around you that's going to kind of like pick you up and keep you moving, because you just need to keep applying if you're going to win. Okay, so Carlisle, three factories closed between 2008 and 2010 in a town of just under 20,000 people. They lost 4,000 jobs in 3 years. It was absolutely devastating, along with a very large fire. So in between 2013 and 2015, we started revitalization planning. We were very lucky to get a Brownfield area-wide grant and then also some assessment grant dollars that we were able to use to create a vision. If you look in the picture on top, that is from our, you know, area-wide, where we started to plan, like, what, instead of a broken down factory that's burned to the ground, what can it be? Because until you get to what can it be, you can just be completely and totally overwhelmed by how large these brownfields are. So we used these, you know, limited dollars that we were very lucky to get to start that visioning process and to bring the community along with us and to create a resource roadmap. Okay. Using that roadmap, we broke down into, you know, the kind of the layer cake idea that Matt showed you. You know, what kind of cleanup did we need to do? What kind of roadways and sidewalks and transit did we need in the project for it to be a success? In Carlisle, the factories were in the lowest income area of the borough that had horrible, you know, stormwater issues, horrible, not really good park infrastructure. So, you know, how can we, as we're doing this redevelopment, also help the community along and improve their lives? What kind of park amenities should we have? Should we have public art? The answer is always yes. Job training. We went after job training dollars in partnership with the local community college to try to make sure when all these infrastructure jobs are available that local residents could benefit from those jobs. We needed new mixed income housing and desperately needed economic development opportunity. So we started working with professionals, that team I was talking about, on what these costs would be, right? Because you just know you need a road, you don't know how much that road is. Yeah. When you wake up and you realize you need $15 million worth of roadway improvements, you need to know what each segment costs so you can get there. And then, you know, matching funding sources to priority needs. We knew we had, you know, $30, $40 million of needs, some of which the private sector could help us with, but a lot of those were utility improvements, roadway improvements, stormwater improvements, and we worked really closely with the county and the school district, and we were able to get TIF funding, tax increment financing funding through that we were then able to use to leverage multi-million dollars worth of grants. We did indeed create that briefing sheet that Matt showed you. I don't know how many of those briefing sheets we handed them out. We handed them out to not only our legislators at the federal and state area, but also, you know, down to the county, local municipalities surrounding us, the transit agency, everyone we needed to pull into this project to make it successful got a briefing sheet. And we did. We went on the road. I don't know how many times we drove from Carlisle to D.C., but it was a lot. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Carlisle, but it within Carlisle is Carlisle Events, which hosts the largest car shows in the United States, and one of those car shows is a very popular Corvette show. Okay, so what did all this work get us in Carlisle? It got us a lot of funding. $1.4 million in Pennsylvania Industrial Site Reuse funding, $2.2 million in Pennsylvania Redevelopment Assistance, $5 million in a USDOT Tiger Grant, $5 million in PennDOT Multimodal Grant, and that had a former version of this slideshow presentation, $400,000 in Federal Highway TAP Grants, $500,000 in Pennsylvania Natural Resources Grants, $90,000 in HUD CDBG Grants, $600,000 in Chesapeake Bay Stewardship Funds, a $10,000 NEA Artworks Grant, $200,000 for that Environmental Workforce Grant, and then we used all of that grant funding with the TIF funding to leverage private investment into those three areas. In 2016, I moved to Glenwood Springs to become the city manager, and we had a brownfield as well, but I also wanted to talk about our South Glenwood projects as well, so I'll bring that up after I talk about our brownfield. If you haven't been to Glenwood Springs, it's a beautiful historic city on the western slope of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. It is unique in that it sits at the confluence of both the Roaring Fork River and the Colorado River. If you have not been here, the top picture is the largest outdoor hot springs in the United States. The confluence area, if you look at the picture, you can see where the, if you look pretty closely, you can see the sewer plant that was right at the confluence of those two rivers that was moved about a decade ago, and it kind of just sat vacant. It's clearly the most developable, beautiful land in all the city of Glenwood Springs. So we started working on a roadmap, and I started talking to Matt and his firm again as soon as we got out here. We got an EPA area-wide grant, and that allowed us to start making progress in this area. The vision that, you know, we came up with is the lower picture. The top picture is the highway into Glenwood, into our town. It is actually the last piece of the interstate highway built in the United States because of how difficult it was to build. But getting back to the confluence, the vision that we drew up with the community was a riverfront park along the confluence, over 113,000 square feet of commercial retail community space, mixed income housing, because all of the western slope and resort communities in Colorado have horrible affordable housing challenges. It also included transit hubs, complete streets, trails, and structured parking. We went ahead and we were able to get some targeted brownfield assistance. We got $200,000 area-wide planning grants. We were able to do something unique using this vision here, which was reduce the cost of some projects. There was a really critical connection that we call the 8th Street connection, and we needed to, it could either have been a flat roadway, which we built during a different project, or we were going to have to build a $5 million project that dipped below the railroad and working, using division of the area-wide, we were able to politic with our local communities that are a part of the Roaring Fork Transit Association, and we just got that $5 million additional project we no longer had to do. So you can use these visions to not only get grant money, get grant funding, but also reduce the costs in very unique scenarios. This area is also in an opportunity zone. So more to come on that. We were really ready to go in February of this year, right before COVID hit. And we put a pause on it right now, which is why I wanted to kind of talk about South Glenwood. But, you know, we will get back to this project and we will move it forward. South Glenwood is, you know, a part of our town in Glenwood Springs that has significant infrastructure challenges that we've been making progress on. When I got to Glenwood Springs, my city council wanted us to find about $100 million to do everything all at once, kind of the elephant scenario. So we did not do that. We put a moratorium in all development. This area of town had the worst rated bridge in the entire state of Colorado by the time we got around to replacing it. Dangerous intersections that result in fatalities and a failed road called South Midland that 30% of our population lives on, that in April of 2018 there was a road failure on, and we really thought 30% of our population, over 3,000 people, more than that if you include the county population, were going to have the only access out of town was going to be a dirt road through the mountains. Luckily, that did not happen, and then luckily we started using the tools that we already knew about and planned, you know, we started a road resource roadmap to start making large-scale improvements. The first one was that 27th Street Bridge that you can see in the picture. We did something cool. We actually built the bridge next to the existing bridge and slid it over. But before we did that, we needed to find $12 million. We got $1 million from the Colorado Energy and Mineral Impact Assistance Grants, $500,000 from our Federal Mineral Lease Grant, $1.6 million from the Federal Highway Administration Off-System Bridge Program, and $500,000 from our county as, you know, the last piece of funding once we'd already been able to show success in this area. The rest we did use bond funding from a recently approved taxing measure for large-scale infrastructure projects. So we were able to cut that ribbon really in the very beginning of this year, and while at that ribbon cutting, I used the opportunity to talk about the third project with CDOT, which I'll get to after we talk about South Midland. South Midland was that road that I talked about that was on the verge of failure. We're going to go out to bid this November to get it rebuilt. We went after and we were awarded a $7 million U.S. DOT build grant, an $850,000 Garfield County grant, and $150,000 once again from the state of Colorado. It is about a $12 million project as well, so the remaining dollars we'll be using that same bond financing to get. What was pretty crucial about this USDOT build grant is, you know, your legislators, your federal and state legislators, they represent usually what federal ones do, the entire state, right? So I have a city of 10,000 people. How do you convince your senators and representatives that your project is the project that needs to get funded? Well, partially, you just don't go away. We went out to DC from Colorado, which is way further away than it was in Pennsylvania, and we met with one senator, and then we were told by, you know, the staff and both our senators and representatives' office, well, that they really don't want to pick. We'll let you know what they think. And, you know, we kind of said, no, we'll wait. I'll come back. And, you know, we went back the next week when they would be available, and we talked them into supporting it. So part of it is, like, annoying your way very politely into getting these funds. It is very important that you do stay very polite with your senators. So the last final piece of this corridor that we've had significant success on is underpasses or overpasses, we're not quite sure yet, at our 27th Street and Grand Avenue Bridge area. We have gotten $3 million from CDOT, Colorado Department of Transportation, and we're working in partnership with the Roaring Fork Transportation Authority, the same authority that we were able to reduce our other project by $5 million. To build these likely underpasses, we are about $2 million short, and we need to go a little further in design, and then we're going to try to go after those extra $2 million and get this critical pedestrian safety improvement completed.
We'll get there, Deborah.
Well,
$2
million. Okay, that is what I got. Thank you.
Great job, Deborah. Thank you for sharing the keys to success in those wonderful towns, and the difference in the progress that they've made is fantastic. I know that my colleague Abraham Parker has one more slide, but I'm going to go with just the end of this. Changing your communities, revitalizing these dead brownfields, picking up these idle spaces and transforming them into something better is a worthy goal. It's been said that communities can be shaped by choice, but they can be shaped by chance. We can keep on accepting the kind of places we've got, or we can start to create the kind of communities we really want. In order to do that, you will need resources. You will need funding to make this happen. And this may seem like one of the most difficult times to leverage resources and move projects forward, because it's one of the most difficult times that we have in general during this pandemic era and the economic downturn. But I urge you to get forward, to move forward now on a resource roadmap, to put your vision into place and to figure out how you're going to fund that vision and that transformation. Because as Yogi Berra said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. So I urge all of you to move forward down the road, and we've been glad to be with you to talk about road mapping the resources to get there. Abe, I'll turn it back over to you.
Matt, go ahead and do the Q&A, and I'll wrap things up at the very end.
All right, Elise, go for it.
Great. Thank you. All right, so we did have a few questions come in, and please, if anybody else thinks of a question, you can send it in the Q&A box, and we will get to it. So first, I want to ask you, how do you think about and bring in equity into your planning and road mapping activities? And Matt, do you have any new or emerging practices that you could share?
Yeah, that's a great question. Normally, when we do a resource roadmap with the community, or if you're going to do it on your own, we always ask for what I say is a data dump. You know, give us the strategic plans, give us the white papers, give us the notes from the community meeting, give us the minutes of the Planning and Economic Development Council, you know, convening that you had. Show us the PowerPoints, right? And we didn't always say, and we want to see what's come from the neighborhood and the nonprofit groups and from the NAACP and from the Latino Association. We're now trying to be more conscious to say, what are the hopes and dreams and plans and problems and concerns that these organizations have? Okay, that's one thing. The second thing is, we have often said, yeah, at some point during this process, before it was all virtual, we're doing virtual roadmap meetings now, but, you know, invite neighborhood groups and, you know, and other groups that are important to this area that we're trying to fix up, invite them. But we weren't specifically asking about what are the groups that are representing the people of color, the people of in economic distress, The Forgotten. And now we're just much more explicit about it. That's one thing. The second thing is that our firm does a weekly newsletter called the S2, Sustainable Strategy Spotlight. And every week we come out with what grants are emerging and what opportunities for funding are out there. And we've become much more conscious in the last couple months of really trying to find the grants that serve environmental justice, racial equity, support for struggling families. And, when I get my grants list and every week we decide what's going to be in the Wednesday newsletter, we're really looking at a whole new range of sources. So I think it's just being more conscientious of it and more purposeful about including those important concerns in. I will tell you that the EPA Brownfields office has, it's been a while, our firm helped you with it, has a whole toolkit on environmental justice in the Brownfields redevelopment process. I'd urge you to look at that. And I think we should also all expect that maybe our well-laid plans and visions about exactly how something should be might not proceed in exactly that fashion. We might have to incorporate other viewpoints and voices into the community revitalization process that we didn't expect because we weren't as purposeful about those concerns before. So it may take longer, but it'll be better at the end. So that's my thoughts there.
Thanks, Matt. Another question for you is, how well would you say this approach works for tribal communities? And do you have any specific advice for tribal communities that are trying to identify funds?
Right. That's a great question. I think I mentioned earlier today that I'm working with the city of Okemah, Oklahoma, which is now, by order of the U.S. Supreme Court, part of the Muskogee Indian tribe, because all of eastern Oklahoma is now declared part of the, it's all tribal land. And so we were already working in close coordination with tribal nation leaders there. And we'll continue to do so. It's really the same process, except the funding sources are going to be potentially different. There are a number of resources that are designated specifically for tribes and tribal leaders. There are also programs that I found that are available to the general county or city that are not as easily available to tribal resources. I will commend to you one of the partners to EPA's Brownfield office is Kansas State University. KSU has a technical assistance for Brownfields program that supports Brownfields, and the KSU tab, if you look up Kansas State University technical assistance for Brownfields, they are running the tribal Brownfields assistance component of the EPA Brownfields program. They're providing technical assistance, and they have looked at some of these things. I will say, if you haven't figured out your priority projects and what components and phases they're made up of, gathered the stakeholders around to get behind that vision, decided what it costs, and then how it matches what might be a similar, but in some cases, a different set of tribal resources, then you haven't roadmapped. And so I think it's the same. Maybe some different funding sources in there that a non-tribal roadmap would not have.
Thanks, Matt. So this next question is for Deborah, and it's about opportunity zones. I believe Glenwood Springs was in an opportunity zone, if I'm not wrong on that. Please let me know. But to what extent are you seeing actual opportunity zone investments driving projects? And also, Matt, if you want to comment on that too, and do you think that any of these projects might not have happened without opportunity zone support?
The City of Glenwood Springs has two opportunity zones because, once again, we listened to our consultants and went after them. I think not necessarily our brownfields. It was getting a lot of attention because of the opportunity zones, but we have other redevelopment areas that are only happening because of those opportunity zones. We have a mall out in West Glenwood, which has been, is in the process of being purchased and potentially redeveloped because of that opportunity zone. We've had other deals occur that we kind of only know somewhat about, but we know they're happening because of those opportunity zones. And some of the funding we've been able to go after, we've been successful about with because it has extra points awarded to you because they're in opportunity zones. So I believe for the City of Glenwood Springs, they've been extraordinarily beneficial.
Thanks,
I will just build on what Deborah said by saying that it is true that the executive branch has prioritized 180 different sources of funding and resources get preference consideration if they're in an opportunity zone. And so if you have one, you may get a leg up in some of these resource applications that you're pursuing. So you got to roadmap them to figure out which ones you're going after. I would say that. I would say that the jury is still out on whether opportunity zones are going to transform brownfields for a couple of reasons. One is that in our experience, it's mostly the projects that are not only shovel ready, but have their zoning entitlements and their permitting entitlements and already have stacked up most of the capital that they need to be able to be funded before an opportunity zone or an opportunity fund investor is going to come along and put funding into it, particularly when they're going to want a real sense of rate of return. And if you're like, well, we got an old steel mill and we have a picture of what we'd like it to be in 10 years, but we're not that far yet. We haven't even torn down the old steel mills. You're going to have a more difficult time bringing in an investor looking for a financial investment. I frankly think it was the projects that were already well on their way to being done, and then the opportunity fund regulations fell, and people said, oh, I can swap out some more expensive debt or some money that's not as lucrative for me for opportunity funds, and I'll do that. The other reason is, of course, that the big era of opportunity fund investments was supposed to begin in the beginning of 2020, when a lot of the timing for deployment of opportunity fund investments was going to happen, and then, of course, the economy crashed. I'm going to finish by saying a more optimistic note, which is the EPA Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization has a really good set of information and materials that a colleague of mine, Ashley Baddish, and I helped put together, which describes how there are special rules within Treasury's Opportunity Zone regulations to allow you to put Opportunity Fund resources into cleanup, demolition, asbestos abatement, and site preparation, even if you don't necessarily have that ultimate economic real estate project shovel-ready, entitled, and ready to go. And it would take longer to explain how I would use that if I were an investor or a city official trying to use it. But there's real prospects there. And ask EPA's regional brownfields office for information about opportunity zones in brownfields, because there's real promise.
Thanks, Deborah and Matt. All right, so Matt, you talked a bit about setting up meetings to get the word out on your project and your roadmap. Do you recommend sending briefing sheets to federal or state departments or legislators? And if so, who would send that?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Again, I can't emphasize as much. I have 17 steps, and they don't all have to be done in that exact order or sequentially, and different circumstances take you in different directions. But you really aren't drafting briefing sheets until you know what the project is and what it needs and how it should be funded and what you're going for, and you got the match for it. And so give me this, this HUD grant for a choice neighborhood planning redevelopment, because I've figured out all I need to know about that public housing project that needs a $30 million choice neighborhood grant. They're out, by the way. Choice neighborhoods were just opened up by HUD recently. And both of the ones I've worked at have been in brownfields, just to let you know. And so, yes, that's what they're for. They're for PDFing and emailing to everybody and their brother and sister who may be able to give you resources, not just cash, but technical assistance and support and advice and connections to other people who may have those resources. I spend half of my day sending out briefing sheets to folks. And so your project director, your city manager, your assistant city manager for economic development. Deborah, how many times have you sent out a briefing sheet? 100, you know?
Hundreds.
Yeah. Yeah, use them. That's what they're for. They're meant to get people to get excited about your project and call you back.
Thank you. All right. Next question. So for folks living in rural areas that might not have much access to resources, developers and private investment sometimes can be scarce, and local officials sometimes struggle with an attitude of beggars can't be choosers when it comes to visioning. Do you have any advice on how to convince local leaders to dream a little bigger?
Can we take that,
Deborah,
one back?
You want to say something first? Yeah, go. You go first.
I am at Glenwood Springs. It's a pretty rural area, and when I got, one of the reasons I was obviously hired for this position was to bring resource road mapping to, you know, Glenwood Springs. I started kind of like getting my council there a bite at a time. Like, we brought in Matt and his firm for a very, very reasonable amount to just do the area-wide application for us. And so, you know, I was able to show them for, you know, this little tiny bit of money, I was able to get $200,000 to do this visioning non-match. And those, I understand those grants are currently not available, but you can do very similar things with EPA funding that is available. And that I kind of brought them along that way, was, you know, spend a little bit here, see what you can get. By the time we got the build grant, they were just like, yes, whatever you think you need to do, we will do. So it's part, like, you have to show your elected officials the success that you can bring. And you don't want to sign them up for everything all at once or they'll be overwhelmed.
Yeah, I would just add a couple things. So I think implicit in the question is that you may not have the market with hot real estate that's going to get snapped up by developers and bring all their resources into a project. That's a different problem than not really being able to access the state, federal, philanthropic, and other funding. You really have a problem with your market might not be attracting brownfields redevelopment. And I would commend to you the guide that Elise showed on the second or third slide. It's called Community Actions That Drive Brownfields Redevelopment. And that book, which is a step-by-step guidebook, is really meant for weak real estate markets, smaller communities, places that just aren't downtown, you know, New York City, which used to be the most thriving and economically exciting place in the world. It will be again. It's a weird world, isn't it, that New York, Manhattan is abandoned. But you might not live in Manhattan and not have the real estate potential. Read that Community Actions book. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is step 17 in this slide talked about nothing succeeds like success. Maybe you can help bring along your local officials and key stakeholders with smaller successes. I remember seeing the EPA National Conference keynote speaker in Los Angeles in December of 2019, she talked about small steps of activating an empty lot and doing small, sometimes people call it tactical urbanism or what do they call it, a guerrilla urbanism, where you put out a mural or you put out benches in a particular place and you start to activate places, and then you can do more and more development. Maybe you need to start small and make people believe that this broken down town doesn't have to stay broken down forever. There are things that we can do. Then the third thing I would recommend is that you try to get some funding or other resources, maybe a university design department or someone to come in and do visioning with you to create what you would like that part of town or your downtown to look like 10 years from now if money were no object. And then once you got the vision, I remember being with the mayor of Des Moines, Iowa about 25 years ago, and he looked at the EPA brownfield chief at the time, who was a woman named Linda Garzinski, and he said, "Linda, we've got the vision and we've got the community backing. All the rest is just money. So why don't you give me some grant money so I can keep moving?" And well, he got it. And Des Moines now has got a pretty vibrant downtown. The final thing I would say, actually, I lied, I got one more thing, which is that there are just about as many resources at the federal level for rural localities as there are for urban. And in fact, there are some places that are prioritized for rural localities. And this current administration has really enhanced that and tried to put as much money into rural America as urban America. So don't hesitate to go get it.
Thank you. All right. So next question is for Deborah or both of you, if you'd like to both share. How difficult has it been to get community support for bond financing or tax increases for these projects?
I would say both of my instances, it was actually fairly easy because of the vision that was built around it. It would have, you know, getting school districts to agree to TIF funding, you will not get unless you have that vision. So that is really what is integral.
Amen. Deborah's right. If, you know, both of Deborah's communities, the projects she's done is got artist renderings, it's got economic impact reports, it's got job impact projections, and without being able to show people those things, you know, they don't know what they're funding and they're not going to get behind it with bond financing and tax increases. So the vision really needs to lead. That's why it you know, the first slide in the process here was convene your team. The second slide is get the vision together. I agree.
Great. All right. And, you know, unfortunately, we're living in the time of COVID. And I believe, Matt, you mentioned SurveyMonkey and virtual meetings. Could you speak to any other virtual outreach for stakeholders that you've used or heard about being successful? And are there any other techniques that might have changed because of COVID?
I'm still trying to figure it out myself. It's not as easy.
We have done one, it's different, so it doesn't apply directly to this, but we've been doing, because of all the community anxiety between trying to balance our economy and public health, we have done two listening sessions. And I would say we use software that called every household that they had numbers to and did a virtual town hall that had over 400 people in it. So it wasn't about this, but it was effective. So I think you need to look for those tools that get people's attention more than you typically would.
Deborah, you and I were planning big old events in April. Right in the heart of your town, we were going to convene everybody for the 50th anniversary of Earth Day and do big things. Maybe we'll do it for the 51st, the first anniversary of Earth Day.
That's a deal.
I hope so. All right. also sort of just generally, how often would you say you should update your roadmap or briefing sheet or funding matrix?
You know, our firm with our key clients, you know, Deborah's one of them, we try to do it every year. Sometimes it slips to a little bit longer. You really need to think about it at milestones. I mean, sometimes there are natural corners that you turn on a project where, wow, we've been working for a year to get this project shaped up and we've received planning funding, we're moving toward getting shovel ready, we're going to be more competitive for some of the construction grants. It's time to revisit and see, you know, if all our target resources are still the key ones that we're going for. So we try to do that. And then, of course, in this age with, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars coming out of Washington to try to jumpstart the economy again, you need to be looking creatively at those. And if your roadmap predates the virus, you're probably not thinking about, you know, the EDA CARES Act $1.5 billion or the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which put out $150 billion that is being used to revitalize buildings to serve the community in places all across the country. You should be updating your roadmap for this new era. And again, I will say, if you're not starting to think about where you're going to be with key infrastructure projects, you're probably not going to be ready for a big, fat infrastructure bill that will probably happen by this time next year.
All right. So we still have a couple questions left. So it sounds like one of our participants might have some trouble with a private landowner who's not being the most cooperative, and their vision might not match what the community is thinking about for the site. Do you have any suggested approaches or strategies for handling that situation?
Yes. You know, every question I turn to Elise and her team has a guidebook on that. And I drafted a guidebook with the EPA Brownfields office. I guess it's probably been 10 years now, but I think the lessons in it are still there. And it's called Revitalizing Mothballed Brownfields. The ones that have gotten mothballed by either big corporations, sometimes you have a big Fortune 500 factory that is all lawyered up and able to pay the tax bill, and they're not letting you inside because they may be fearful about the contamination issues. They may have other plans that they're not coordinating with the community on. That's one kind of mothballed property. And then there's another that I call the mom and pop mothballs, and that is the kid who inherited the site from dad who used to run the junkyard there, and now he and the brother and sister don't live in town, and they don't want to be bothered with your goofy economic development plans. And if you pay me a gazillion dollars, maybe I'll consider selling it. That kind of mothballing. And that guidebook, Revitalizing Mothballed Properties, has a lot of good lessons in it. I was on a city council for 10 years in a place that was filled with brownfields when we got started. And I think you need to approach people with sugar rather than vinegar. And if they don't eat the sugar, pour vinegar over their head. That's what I'll say.
Thanks, Matt.
That could take a more lengthy explanation, but, you know, there are carrots and there are sticks. Always start with the carrot. But also show them how all their neighbors who have brownfields are making money as the properties get transformed. And, you know, maybe they won't hold out forever. At some point, you got to get serious with them. So read the mothball book.
All right. For Deborah, how much public local money did you see that you needed to invest in these projects before you were successful in getting some grant funds and other leveraging?
It would depend specifically on the project. For the bill grant we got in Glenwood Springs, we really had to design it. So a couple hundred thousand dollars in design for the, you know, USDOT grant that we got in Carlisle. That was years worth of efforts. It was our third application. It required a lot of endless work in many different things. And I would say that we still didn't really need to put that much public money into it, maybe about, you know, $1 million designing. So actually building was a different thing for, you know, for Glenwood Springs. We've had to use $22 million of our tax increment financing to match both of those projects. So we got a little over half of what we needed for those two, the bridge and the road. Did that make sense?
I'll add to Deborah, at the confluence of the rivers in Glenwood Spring where the abandoned sewer plant is, you actually started out with some targeted brownfield assessment dollars from EPA Region 8, which didn't cost much for the community to get started. And then that led into a EPA area-wide planning grant, which did not require a match. I mean, you put resources in, of course, and that created the vision. And then you were preparing to go to the private sector, and you put out an RFP for developers to do the redevelopment of that area. And, you know, I joined with you in February to talk about launching that, and that was in the before time. And so that's on the shelf at the moment. But the question that we were moving to next was, what are we going to be able to get the private sector to do to fund, and what further public infrastructure resources are we going to have to get to redevelop that confluence? That was very important to the city council, still is. But I don't think we ever would have gotten to the point where we could even have that negotiation and collaboration and ultimately a deal with private sector developers about that if you hadn't done everything you did with the road mapping and planning. That helped you set the table to have that discussion, and hopefully we'll be back to it soon.
All right, and I believe this is our last question to wrap things up for both of you. What kind of financial reporting challenges come up from knitting together this large number of funding sources, and do you have any suggestions to help with reporting?
Why don't I take that one? I spent time as not only a grant writer, but also a grant manager before becoming an assistant borough manager. If you're going to go after these kind of dollars, you have to be willing to hire not a grant writer necessarily, but absolutely a grant manager. You need to put aside, you just need to include that as a cost of your grant that you're going to manage over the years. You absolutely need to help your finance department, and you absolutely need someone tracking these grants, because the worst thing you can do is get a large grant, screw it up, and then have to give the money back. So it's just part of the process. You have to be committed to it.
I will say that what I do for a living, trying to help communities with these strategies and finding the funding and advocating for it, I love my job. I tell just about every client that I'm not managing your grants, because they're really labor-intensive, precise, detail, compliance requirements, kind of a pain in the neck. And I think you do need to know that there is a component of that. I don't think the financial reporting is necessarily more difficult if you're leveraging multiple sources together. Each one is going to have its own compliance reporting and documentation that it has to do. You do have to be careful to not use the same dollar to match every grant you've got. Some grants are more explicit that if you have used a dollar to match one grant, you may not use it to match this grant. Sometimes you can be more flexible, and and say the project costs $1 million and we've got $200,000 into it from this source, and that will be able to match other resources to make up the $800,000. So you're going to have to keep track of the interplay of match, but it's a lot of work, but not necessarily more complicated than any community can handle if they put their mind to it.
And I think I just want to clarify very quickly, you don't, I meant to say, you don't necessarily need a grant writer on staff to go after these large federal grants. You absolutely need a grant writer with experience and the ability to lobby and to teach you how to lobby.
All right. Well, I think that finishes up the question answer section. I want to say thank you again so much to you, Deborah and Matt, for presenting today. And with that, I will turn things over to Abe to close us out. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Elise. And thank you, Matt and Deborah. And thank you, everybody, for attending today. We did get several questions about whether slides and other materials and sample resource roadmaps and sample briefing sheets are available. The answer is yes. The slides are available right now, and samples of all those resources, as well as all the resources that Matt and Deborah mentioned, like the Brownfields Federal Programs Guide and the CDFA information, are available online at the seminar homepage, which you can reach by the seminar homepage link right on the right side of your screen under related URLs. Also, this webinar was recorded. The recording will be publicly available in about a week. You will all get an email when that is available. Please feel free to share it with any colleagues who might have missed. And just in closing, on the seminar homepage, there is a feedback form. Please fill it out and let us know how you did. And on this slide right here, there's information to stay connected with updates on any future webinars. And with that, I will officially close the webinar, and thank you all, and have a great afternoon. Goodbye.